evening, everybody. Let's begin by cultivating our motivation and having a genuine sense of joy at having a human life with all the facilities and opportunities necessary to learn the Dharma and practice it. And think how just the lack of one small thing, and there goes our whole opportunity to learn and practice the Dharma. So right now we have all the conditions, and so it's really important to make use of them, because although we feel like we're going to live forever, we know we aren't. And we're not quite sure where we will be reborn, and if we'll have the opportunity to practice then. So let's live our life in a really vital way, in a way that makes the best use of our time and our energy, so that we can free ourselves from cyclic existence, generate the wish that all others to be free as well, and therefore to aim for full enlightenment so that we can bring that about. So let's really expand our mind to so that it thinks not just about my happiness, especially not about my happiness now, but really thinks about the long-term happiness of each and every living being, and wants to work for that purpose, for some meaningful, lasting goal, something that will really make a difference in the long term. So cultivate that motivation now. Respond to first before we get into this evening's teachings. So the question says, I'm turning a lot over and over in my head as I contemplate self-centered thought. In my meditations this week, I've thought about my tendency towards self-centered thought and the relationship between self-centered thought and memory. My ego and my self-centered attitudes really manipulate not only the creation of memories, but also select events that my memory clings to. Ring a bell? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So while we think that we remember things exactly the way they happened, forget it. That, we're picking out certain details of certain events, and then we are weaving those details into a storyline. And we're not realizing that we're the ones who are selecting the details out, weaving the storyline, and instead we think that our memories are an objective reality, what really happened. Okay, so that's going to bring some problems, isn't it? I also use memory in creating a false sense of a substantial permanent self. For example, I remember when I was 4, There is no substantial I, but memory seems to reinforce this concept over and over by its very nature. Sometimes it seems memory, at its very core, serves as a slave to ego and results in wrong views. So I think what she's saying here is that while when we investigate using a probing awareness, we see that there's no substantial findable person. But the way we use our memory to create the idea of one, yeah, then makes us think that there is such a real person. Okay, so we remember when we were four. Remember we talked a few weeks ago about the general I and the specific I? Okay, so if we talk about this life, then the general I is this life, and the specific I is when I was 4 years old, when I was 5 years old, when I was, 39, 49, 59, whatever it is. Okay, and how those are all the selves at the different times are different selves, because we aren't the same at 4 as we are at 34, but they all are parts of, when we say the self of this life, they are all parts of the one general self of this life. Okay, but when so often when we think of ourselves, especially when there's very strong memories that were of a very bad time or a very good time, then we say, I remember this, or this happened to me. And it's as if, almost as if, not quite, but almost as if, we feel we're the same person now as the person that event happened to. Okay? And so then all these feelings come up, and all the drama returns, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And this feeling of a real, true me who's definitely like this emerges. And we hold on to it, because of the way we misinterpreted the memories and used the memory just to create this, appearance of a false self. Okay, so this creates some problems, doesn't it? Yeah, especially when we get very attached to our stories. This happened when I was 2, and then this happened when I was 3, and this happened when I was 4, when I was 5, and so as an adult, this is the kind of person I am, the trauma I have, and how unloved I was, and appreciated, and we form a whole identity around it. And we believe it's true. We believe that's who we really are. Yeah. So first of all, we believe that there's this solid person. And then we believe that that solid person is, the summation of all these stories, which were created by selective memory and inappropriate attention. Yeah. So this isn't to say that we forget everything, because if we forgot everything, then we'd wake up tomorrow, we wouldn't know how to read and write or talk, So I'm not saying that the idea to overcome this is to forget the past, but to be able to see, to understand what memory is correctly, and to see how subjective it is, and to see the storyline we impute on all these selected memories, and to see how that's an artificial construct of who we are as a person. It's not who we really are. And I think if the more we can understand this, the more we're free psychologically from carrying around things that happened in the past. Yeah, because we'll realize that the past is over. It is not happening now. It happened to that person, but who we are now is not that person. Okay, and thus it's more advantageous to greet each day and, in fact, each moment in a fresh way, instead of carrying this baggage with us from the past. When the Maasai were here visiting us, do you remember that Nicholas said that you remember the past only as much as it helps the present and the future? The past that doesn't help you in the present and future, you know, it's better to understand that, you know, not to cling on to that as if it were still happening, not to make it a bigger deal than it actually is. Okay, so her question was, what are some tactics or Dharma practices that I can use to better grasp the precious phenomena of human memory, and how can I use it for the benefit of others, not myself? How does Buddhism regard the gift of memory? Well, memory basically is a mental factor, and it's the same mental factor that is often translated as mindfulness. Okay? And so when we say mindfulness, what we're really talking about in the context of everyday life is remembering our precepts, remembering our values, and so on, so we can live according to them. And mindfulness in terms of meditation practice is remembering the object of meditation so that we don't go, you know, wandering the universe with our distraction. So memory is, you know, or mindfulness is a mental factor. It's there. We can't remove it. But like I said, the idea is to use it in a wise way and not get caught up with the conceptualization of false memories, but to use memory to focus on our precepts, our values, our determinations, our aspirations, you know, how we want to be as a human being, what things we don't want to do, okay? To use our memory to focus on our object of meditation, yeah? To use our memory to focus on the kindness of others, yeah? Seeing what they have, how much they've benefited us, and remembering that so that we don't take others' kindness or others' presence in our lives for granted. Okay. So I think the whole thing is learning to use memory in a skillful way, yeah, not just pretending it doesn't exist or ignoring it. Okay? But it's quite interesting to see, you know, when we start to meditate, what comes up in terms of memory. Yeah? And you might remember a few years ago, one nun who had done 6 years of retreat was telling us that, you know, so much stuff came up during her retreat, like the ants go marching one by one. you remember that? And all these ridiculous, you know, jingles and different things that we learned as kids that we haven't thought of in who knows how many years. But that imprint is still there. And when the mind gets, you know, a little bit more quiet, then all this garbage kind of is vomited it up, you know. And then we can either reject it with horror, which just creates a lot of tightness in our mind, or we can attach to it, saying, oh yeah, I remember this and that, and oh, this TV program, and I get completely lost in reminiscing about the past. Or we can just say, this is a distraction in my meditation, and then come back to our meditation object. Okay? So how we deal with these things is really the key. Okay? Okay, now back to where we were. So, we were talking about the self that is to be negated. In other words, the self that does not exist that we believe exists. Okay, so this is an inherently existent self, one that seems to be findable if we analyze amongst its parts exactly what it is. It feels like we should find it either in its parts or separate from its parts. It appears very solid. It appears independent of other things, so independent of causes and conditions, of parts, of any relationship with any other factor, of independent from being imputed by terms and concepts. Okay? So it seems to be this truly real, findable, individual, most important, most worthy of paying a lot of attention to and protecting to our dying day, me. Okay? So we walk around with this feeling of me most of the day, thinking that it really exists the way it appears to us. But when we analyze, we see that we can't find it, okay? So when we apply ultimate analysis, which is analysis looking for what the word me or I really refers to, so it's not just saying, where's Jeff, and then Jeff's sitting on the chair over there. That's conventional analysis. You know, he's a, you know, football player, and he's, you know, weighs 100 pounds, and he, you know, is sitting on the green chair, and, you know, okay? So that's conventional analysis of Jeff. But ultimate analysis is, you know, who is he really? So similar with ourselves, who am I really? You know? So when we start to do that analysis and look, okay, then when we're doing this ultimate analysis, we cannot single out something that's either within the body and mind or separate from the body and mind that we can draw a circle around and say this absolutely, positively, forever and ever, is the heart of meanness. This is my essential identity. Okay? We can't find anything. Yeah. Feels like there's such a self there. But when we look, we can't identify anything. Okay? Because we're not our body. We're not our mind. You think, well, maybe I am my mind. But then which mind? We have a lot of different minds, don't we? Visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, mental consciousness, a lot of different moods and emotions. Can you isolate one mental state that is me forever, unchanging? Yeah. And we can't identify a person that's separate from the body and mind either. Yeah. So the only conclusion we can reach is that such an inherently existent I doesn't exist, either conventionally or ultimately. Okay, that's the Prasangika view. Now, our friends, or I should say our cousins, the Svatantrikas, they say, but, if there's nothing you can identify as the essence of who you are, or as the essence of any phenomena, and if things only exist by depending on being labeled by term and concept, then anything could be called anything. Yeah? Then there's nothing, you know, in this body and mind that, you know, should be called children or should be called me or, you know, there it could be something else totally. Yeah. If there weren't something in this cup that made it really a cup, we could call it a golf ball. Yeah. But if you call it a golf ball, you know where they're going to send you. Yeah. So the Svatantrikas say, but there has to be something in the object that, you know, is the referent of that term, because otherwise you could call anything anything and it would become whatever you call it. And that clearly isn't the case. Okay? But the Prasangikas say, no, you know, let me continue with the Svatantrikas. So they say, sure, on the ultimate level there's nothing findable, but on the conventional level there's something you can identify as the object. And the Prasangikas say, but if you say there's something on the conventional level, then that's as good as saying that the object has some truly essential nature that is it, in which case you should be able to identify it and find it, and there's no such thing. Okay? So even within the Madhyamaka school, the middle way school, you have these two different views, and there's quite a debate going on. And even in our own meditation, we can find it, can't we? You know, you follow the Prasangika reasoning, and then when you don't find who you are, then you feel, oh, I don't exist, and then you freak out, not realizing that there is a dependently existent I. And then you say, but there has to be something there that's the essence of me-ness. Because I am an individual. And I do exist. So we think that existence means inherent existence. And emptiness means total non-existence. And both of those are incorrect. Okay? So, we need to be very careful when we're meditating. Not to, you know, just kind of slide over to the Svatantrika thing that, oh yes, there actually is something that really truly is the referent of the word. Okay? Yeah. Because it does feel uncomfortable to say that things exist merely by mere imputation, doesn't it? It feels like, you know, everything would just be chaos. And that everything would disappear if nobody were imputing it. Or that you could impute anything as anything and it would become that. Okay? So sometimes saying that things exist depending on imputation, it feels like, oh, this is going to be chaos. Yeah? So then we latch on to something. Oh, therefore there really is some essence. Something that makes it really this, that makes it worthy of being called this. Yeah, then we feel comfortable. But then the problem is, if there really is that, you should be able to find it, and when we analyze, we can't. Okay? So we somehow got to get used to this idea that things are unfindable when you analyze, but on the conventional level, they exist by imputation. Okay? And the fact that they're imputed doesn't mean that they're non-existent. That's the whole meaning of existence, is existence by imputation. There's no other kind of existence, even though our mind wants to, feels like there should be one. You had a question?
Can you explain imputation?
Imputation. Imputation means to label or designate or give a name to. Okay. Okay, so we were talking about the selflessness of persons and talking about, you know, applying this whole analysis to ourself as the person, okay, as the I. And then remember that there's this one mental factor, the view of the personal identity, yeah, that's an incorrect mental factor that grasps at I and mine as being truly existent. So we just finished negating the I part of it, and then there's the mind part of it. The mind that thinks my, mine. You know, that thought that we glue onto everything, don't we? Yeah, this is mine. I think that's why they call it the terrible twos, because that's when the kids really learn the idea of mine. And then we keep elaborating on it, you know, after terrible twos and everything is mine. Okay. But the thing is that without an I, we can't find a self-existent I, then we can't find a self-existent mine either. Because we only talk about mine in relationship to there being an I. Okay. So if we negate the I by analysis, then we can't find a mine either. But it's very interesting to look at this idea of my or mine and how it affects our life. Yeah? And how we see things different as soon as we give them the label mine. Yeah? They look totally different. Yeah. There's this person there. You walk by him on the street. No big deal. As soon as you call them my friend or my boyfriend, my girlfriend, then they become a big deal. There seems to be some mindness inside of them. Or my car. Or I watch this, you know, when I travel, my seat on the airplane. Okay? I want a seat on the aisle. I don't want to be a seat in the middle between two big men that are squishing me. You know, this is my seat. It's not your seat. You know, there's a real myness to this seat. But it's fascinating because 1 second after they ding the bell and say you can stand up and collect your belongings to start deplaning, then my whole view of the seat totally changes. Yeah? And I have absolutely no attachment to it at all. There's no sense of my at all in that seat. Whereas 2 seconds ago when I was so in it, boy, nobody else is going to claim this seat. This is mine. Yeah? It's fascinating to watch that. Yeah? How just, you know, some small thing and a change in our mind and then the whole thing, we relate to it different. Okay? So this also figures into the meditation on exchanging self and others. You know, how we say my happiness, my body, my memories, my identity, my social status, all these kinds of things, and imagine exchanging them with those of others. Okay? It becomes hard. How can I call somebody else's body I? It's not I, it's not me. This one's me. But then this one actually belongs to my parents. Came from my parents. And all the farmers grew the food that I ate. So why do I identify so strongly with this body as mine and not with another body as mine? Quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I feel the pain and pleasure from this body. Well, that's nice, but, you know, what makes it mine? Yeah? And who is the owner of it? Who's the owner of this body? Okay. So just think, they're very good to question, you know, investigate, see if we can find. Okay, so we are moving on here. So then we come to the topic of the selflessness of phenomena. I'm summarizing some of the previous sections here. And so we examine it in because the first was the examining and trying to understand the selflessness of person, so the lack of an inherently existent I and mine, and now understanding the selflessness of phenomena. Meaning, and here the phenomena refer to our aggregates, okay, the body, feelings, discriminations, conditioning factors, and consciousness, okay, the five aggregates. So we can analyze the, you know, phenomena in terms of the five aggregates. We can analyze, you know, to understand the selflessness of phenomena in terms of analyzing our sense sources. In other words, the consciousness, the sense organ, and the object of it, and to see how they're interdependent. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that we can, different ways that we can chop up or categorize phenomena and then see if any of them exist truly and independently. Okay? And so, included in this way is the way of refuting whether something is born or arises from self, others, both or causelessly, which I'm not going to go into right now, but that's one of the refutations. We can also look at something, you know, take the lamp or the bell or the telephone or something, and analyze it in terms of its parts and see how what we call a telephone depends on the parts of the telephone. Okay, that we can't have a telephone without its parts, that the telephone doesn't exist as some solid thing, but it's dependent on parts, and yet it is not its parts. Okay, so saying something is dependent on something is not the same as saying it is that thing. Okay, and look at how the book is dependent on the pages and the cover. Yeah, so seeing how those things are dependent on their parts, seeing how they're dependent on their causes, you know, that everything arises from causes, and those causes are not the object. Okay? Just as the parts are not the object. So then what you find is that there's, well, in the sense of part, and doing the analysis of parts, you have what they call parts and part possessors. Okay, this is technical vocabulary. Part possessor is a funny name, but it would be like the the wheels, the axle, the engine are the parts. What is it that possesses the parts is the car. Okay, so you can't have a car without having car parts. But also, you can't have car parts without having a car. That doesn't mean that a wheel only becomes a car part when it's on the car. Because you can go to shops that market car parts and there's just a wheel there or just an axle there. But because car, you know, so what I'm saying is it doesn't need to be a part of a car at that specific moment to be a car part. But because there are cars that are formed of those kinds of things, the part is also dependent on the part possessor, not only the part possessor being dependent on the part. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? So the first way of thinking it, that the part possessor depends on the parts, the car depends on the car parts, you know, that's fairly easy to see. But then when we're moving into the part possessors, the parts depend on the part possessor, that the car parts depend on the car, then we're moving into this dependency mutual dependency. Okay? And this thing of mutual dependency is quite interesting to think about, because whenever we pick out an item, we see it as an individual item that is definitely that thing, independent of anything else. But when we think about it, it is only that thing in relationship to the whole environment in which it exists. Okay? And in which we can discern it as something separate from other things. Okay? So, you know, take a tissue. Okay, we look at the tissue and it seems like this is a real tissue, right? Here, you know, this is a tissue from its own side. Any idiot knows it's a tissue. But if you think about it, it's only a tissue because there's human beings who use it to blow their nose or wipe up things that have, you know, ripe up messes. You know, this isn't a tissue from its own side. It's only a tissue, and it all, you know, we call it a tissue because it performs the function of, you know, absorbing things. Okay? But if it weren't for all the things it absorbed, if it weren't for the agent who uses it to absorb those things, yeah, if it weren't for our world existing exactly the way it is, this thing would not be a tissue. Okay? So it's an interesting thing to see how our minds kind of go in, we can go in and out of, oh, but this is something that's there and dependent, to, well, this exists in the context of everything else that's around it. Yeah. Without this context of everything else, with this thing, if it sat out in outer space by itself, you know, it would be totally different, wouldn't it? Who would call it a tissue? There's nothing to absorb, no noses to wipe, no spots to, you know, to dry up. Then, yeah, it wouldn't perform that function. We wouldn't call it a tissue. Yeah? So if we look at anything, it's interesting to think, too, because people get very attached to their careers. Yeah, whatever your career is, I am a this. You know, and that forms a big part of our identity. And sometimes when we don't have a specific career, we feel like a little bit, yeah. But we only have a career because all of society functions in the way it does. If there weren't all these other careers, if there weren't all these other sentient beings who needed all these services, then there wouldn't be our career, our job, there wouldn't be, you know, the education that taught it to us. So we begin to see that this whole thing we identify with so strongly is not some independent career, but it's just something that exists in this whole very complicated matrix of the entire society. Yeah? I mean, you were a lawyer. If there were no other human beings, you wouldn't be a lawyer. Yeah? If there were no laws, you wouldn't have been a lawyer. Okay? So that whole thing is just something that is created by human beings' minds and human beings' needs. And it's nothing that exists independently out there. Okay. So quite interesting to, you know, to do that and look at that. Okay? And then in terms of our sense, when we analyze the sense objects, okay, to see how perception occurs. Yeah, so there's green and there's the eye organ, which is some subtle material on the backside of the eye. That's how they describe it in Buddhist terms. It probably would refer to what the rods and cones, yeah, on the retina. And then there's the eye consciousness. And how it seems like this is green, completely independent of my eye and my eye consciousness. And that my eye is independent and is, you know, unrelated to the green and the visual consciousness, and that the visual consciousness, it feels like it's some independent entity out there that's just waiting to see something. Okay, but if we analyze, you know, all these things only become what they are in relationship to each other. You don't have a visual consciousness apprehending green that's independent of the green and independent of the eye organ. And you don't have an eye organ that is, you know, used as the thing that connects the object to the consciousness, unless you have the object and the consciousness. And this doesn't become green unless there's living beings that perceive it. Because if nobody perceives it, then there would be no way to even tell it existed, so it certainly wouldn't be green. So when we start to look in that way too, we see that our usual notion of perception with concrete object, concrete sense power, concrete consciousness, that all these things don't exist that way, that they all exist in dependence upon each other. Okay? So there's all these different ways of doing the analysis. Yeah, that's quite interesting. Now, we might even think Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are independent, self-existent, absolute entities there. But, you know, Buddha only becomes Buddha because there was the Dharma that was actualized in that mind stream. And because, you know, Shakyamuni was once a Bodhisattva, was once a Sangha member. Without there being the Sangha, without there being the Dharma, there couldn't be the Buddha. Yeah. And the Dharma can't exist without the Sangha and the Buddha because the Dharma is the realizations in their minds. And the Sangha can't exist without the Dharma because the Dharma is their realizations. And they can't exist without the Buddha who taught the path for them to practice. So, you know, when you look even at our objects of refuge, they only exist in mutual dependence upon each other. Mm-hmm. And they actually, there's this beautiful way that they talk about it. Nagarjuna talks about it, I think it's chapter 24, if I'm not right, in the Kurikas. If I'm not wrong, I mean. Where he analyzes and shows that, you know, you have the three jewels, you know, because of the Dharma refuge, and you have the Dharma refuge because it's the last two noble truths. And you have those two noble truths because there's the four noble truths. And, you know, you have all of that because things are empty of true existence. Without emptiness, then you wouldn't have the third and fourth noble truths, so you wouldn't have the four noble truths, so you wouldn't have the two truths, so you wouldn't have the Dharma refuge. And so on, so on. But really showing how the whole thing is completely interdependent. You know, and how it all depends on things lacking inherent existence. Okay. It's a very, very, very beautiful way, you know, that Nagarjuna has of connecting all these things. Okay. So, something inherently existent is something that can stand on its own, so it should exist as it appears to the mind that's perceiving it. Something that stands on its own, that has its own nature, then should be exactly, you know, really some objective object. So that would mean that it should exist the way it appears to us, you know, by the mind that's perceiving it. And that's the way we go through life, isn't it? We think everything we perceive exists in the way we perceive it. But, if, you know, if things existed the way, if things were truly existent and they existed and they would have to exist the way they appeared to the mind perceiving it, then when we look in a mirror and we see a face that looks like a real face, it should be a real face. Mm-hmm. And when we look at asphalt that is shimmering with a mirage, it should be real water because it appears to be real water. And when we look at a television and there's the appearance of people in it, there should be real people because it appears that way to our mind. Okay, so even these gross, you know, if things were truly existent, these very gross examples would also have to exist the way they appear, but they clearly don't. Okay, so that's using gross examples. But then, of course, when we look at each other, we think that the people we see exist the way that they appear to us. And when we think of situations, we think they exist the way they appear to us. But again, if we start to analyze and see, you know, how does it appear and can I really find what I think exists there, then the whole thing evaporates. Yeah. And I think it's quite interesting, like when you think of a person that you're very fond of, you know, and you say, oh, I love this person very much. Yeah. And then you start questioning, who are they? What is it I love? Yeah. Who's this person that I love? Because they appear so vividly. There they are. You know? There's Joe Baloney. And I think he's great. Yeah. And he appears that way to me. But who is Joe Baloney? Who is he? Is he his body? I look through this, his body, you know, where's this wonderful guy, Joe Baloney, that I love? If I look through his body, all I find is blood and guts. Sorry, excuse me, I'm not in love with that. Okay. Then Joe's mind. Yeah, Joe Baloney's mind. Right now he's lying on the couch snoring. Is that mind right now? You know, that's zoned out because he's in deep sleep or he's in REM, you know? Is that the mind that I, that, does that mind really Joe? Is that the Joe that I love, that I never want to be separated from? I always want to be with that mental consciousness that's sleeping. Yeah. So we start to try and identify who is this person that we think is so wonderful that we don't want to, that we cannot exist without. And every single thing we try and identify as being that person, you know, we realize it's not that person. And so then we're left with, well, we can't find some concrete person. Yeah. Joe Baloney exists. He only exists by term and concept. Okay. Because his parents named him. Okay. He only exists because there was a basis of designation and his parents named him Joe Baloney. And that's it. Okay, that's the only person that exists, but some findable person, you know, who is the best thing and the only thing that I never want to be separated from, can't find that. Okay? So, you know, how things appear to us to exist and how they actually do exist, there's a big disparity between the two. Very, very big disparity. And even though this disparity is the nature of things, we are completely blind to it. We're completely blind to it. We're exactly like the kitten who thinks there's another kitten to play with in the mirror. Yeah, we're exactly like that. Yeah, we're exactly like the kid who, you know, looks in the mirror in the Disneyland ride when you're exiting, you know, what was it, the haunted house or haunted mountain or something, and there's a ghost sitting next to me. Oh, there's a ghost. It's a real ghost. Just a hologram. Okay? But we think it's real. So we're exactly like that in terms of believing that things exist the way they appear to us. Okay. Now, there, of course, is a difference between the examples of the face in the mirror and the ghost that's a hologram and the people in the TV set. There's a difference between that and our thinking that another person is truly existent. Okay. There is a difference because, you know, the gross ones are quite gross, and people who haven't realized emptiness can realize those are false appearances. But for the ones where we think there's truly existent people, only, you know, through the analysis of emptiness and through some realization of emptiness can those be seen as false appearances. Yeah?
There's a comment online that says Joe has attributes that are essential to his identity. That is who he is.
Okay, so there's a comment that Joe has attributes that are essential to his identity, and that's who he is. Okay, well, Joe has this attribute, let's say, of being a great musician. Was he a great musician when he was an infant? Okay. If there's a real thing that really is Joe, immutably, independently, Joe should have been a musician when he came out of the womb. He wasn't. And his mother said he took the pots and pans and banged around. Okay, maybe budding musician, but I don't think she wanted him to continue to play his music. Okay, so, you know, if we say those attributes of the person, first of all, it means that that attribute should always be that person without any interruption, without any break, that person should always have that attribute. Manifest, displayed. Okay. It would also mean that of those many attributes, we would have to select one that really is Joe. We couldn't say Joe is a good musician and he's a good football player at 100 pounds. Okay? We couldn't say that. Because which one is the real Joe, the football player or the musician? And when you think about it, if you think, you know, I am my attributes, well, just about every attribute we have can disappear, can't it? Yeah? We say, I'm the one who thinks. Well, what happens if we get Alzheimer's? Are we, you know, when we're very elderly, we can't think so clearly. What happens when we're drunk and we can't think? Or you're stoned and you can't think straight. Okay? So that ability to think isn't something that's continuously there. Descartes was wrong. Yeah. Okay? So if, you know, we would have to isolate one factor that was always there, that never changed. And how can we do that? Because every single attribute about us is changing. We haven't always had it. We won't always have it. Okay? So we can't say that we are our attribute, you know, one attribute. And we can't say that we're a sum of attributes either, because we're back to the whole thing of, if you have five oranges, putting them together doesn't give you an apple. If you have five attributes, putting them together doesn't give you a person. Because you have five things that are not a person, and putting five things that aren't a person together doesn't give you a person. Okay? So, okay, what we have to do with this analysis is take it to the point where we examine the two, we are free from the two extremes. So the two extremes are nihilism and eternalism or absolutism. Okay, when we investigate, we see that there's no common locus or no common basis between something that is inherently existent and something that's dependent. Okay? Can you think of something that is both dependent and exists inherently? Is there a common locus to those two qualities? Okay? Because something existing inherently means that it's independent of all other factors. Can something be independent of all other factors and at the same time arise dependently? No, because dependent and independent are contradictory. So there's no common basis between those. Yeah. When we see that, then we abandon the extreme of eternalism. Because we know that things arise dependently. When we really look, everything arises dependently. If there's nothing that can exist inherently and also be dependent, then we negate inherent existence. Negating inherent existence is abandoning the extreme of absolutism. Because absolutism means inherent existence. Okay. Then the other extreme that we need to abandon is the extreme of nihilism, which is thinking that things are totally non-existent. Okay? And so here we see that something that arises dependently must exist. Okay? Is there anything that arises dependently that is totally non-existent? Is there a common basis of being a dependent arising and being totally non-existent? No. Okay? So when we see that, then we negate nihilism. Because again, we know things are dependent arising. So the only alternative is to negate things being totally non-existent. Okay? So this is why they call dependent arising the king of reasonings, because it can negate both those extremes. Okay? When there's no common basis, when there's nothing which is both dependent arising and inherently existent, we negate absolutism. Okay? When we see that there's nothing that is both dependent arising and totally non-existent, then we negate... Did I goof it up? No, the first one was negating absolutism. Okay, and when we see that there's nothing that is dependent arising and totally non-existent, then we negate nihilism. Okay? So if you've negated absolutism and you've negated nihilism, then those are the two extremes. So that means that things cannot be either inherently existent or totally non-existent. Yeah? But they exist. How do they exist? Dependently? But because things do not appear to us to be dependently existent, that's why we say that things don't exist in the way they appear, because they appear to us to have some essential essence of their own, when really they're totally dependent. So that's why we say they don't exist the way they appear. So to understand what we're talking about here, about things not existing in the way they appear, you have to have behind that the analysis of emptiness and dependent arising. You know, so it's very different than seeing that the face in the mirror doesn't exist in the way it appears. Or that when I dream of, an ocean of chocolate, it doesn't exist the way it appears. Okay? We have time for a couple of questions. Yeah.
You know, the term and concept kind of boggles me up sometimes, but I'm on it again. And I think you've said this before, but so animals and children who don't have terms have concepts and have the same misconception.
Yes.
So why do we tag on term? What's the important
When we say term and concept, I don't think we're necessarily talking about our verbal language terms and like that, but we're talking about something. And similar, when we say concept, we usually think of concepts as words we're telling ourselves, you know, that it's something much more subtle than that. Okay, so that animals have it and babies have it, you know, a baby can discern between its mother and somebody else. Now it doesn't know the name mama. And it doesn't know that mama depends on papa and depends on all these other things to exist. But it does know that mama is a different object than other things are. And that's sufficient for term and concept. Okay? Yeah? And the kitties know. Yeah, they know things. I don't think they have words, but, you know, we're not talking about gross terms and concepts here. Okay. Anything else?
You may have done this in the last discussion, but from what you're saying, if things can't be either non-existent or inherently existent, then emptiness must mean emptiness of inherent existence.
Yes? So you're saying if things are neither inherently existent
or
they're also not non-existent, then they are empty of inherent existence and they arise dependently. So both things. Yeah. And so that's why they say that that dependent arising and emptiness are complementary, that they come to the same point. Okay. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all other and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable and their divine action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kanya Tayani. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Our full tent in depths of generosity, may it stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the West flourish.
So one thing that's very interesting is after you hear a teaching on emptiness, when you do the dedication, think of each word that you're saying in the designation as simply a term, and ask yourself, what is the referent of that term? Yeah, due to this merit. What is merit? What does merit refer to? Is there something I can find that is findable as merit independent of everything else? Yeah. May all sentient beings. What are all sentient beings? Is there one thing that's solid and immutable that's all sentient beings? Or is it something that exists by being labeled independence upon a collection of sentient beings? Or mislabeled, you know, independence upon being different from inanimate things. Okay? Just very interesting as you dedicate, as you talk after that, to think of, you know, kind of I'm using all these words, I think I know what they mean, but is there a findable referent to these words? Okay? So interesting to think like that.